Hello and welcome to Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 47 for April 27th, 2010. My name is Ben Snickoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabier,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three stories for you today. First off, we're going to be talking about Gizmodo and the iPad 4G leak and scandal. Secondly, we're going to talk about Downfall and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the takedowns that occurred there. And finally, we'll be talking about the Sarah Palin hacker trial that just started out in the it's in the South. Starting with the Gizmodo story. So I imagine you'd have to be sitting under a rock to have missed this story here. But the long and the short of it is that at the end of last week, I think it was a Sunday night into Monday morning, Gizmodo started leaking pictures of a rumored to be an iPhone 4G. The fourth generation iPhone that has yet to be announced from Apple. And they leaked what first were some exterior shots, and then they leaked interior shots of it, and essentially, you know, saying that somebody found this in a bar and somebody had left it on a chair. And this was then picked up by everyone. The New York Times ran a story about it, and there were really two angles to this. First off, there was, you know, somebody leaked Apple hardware, which has very rarely leaks. Apple has pretty good clampdown on story leaks like this. And the second story was what Gizmodo did here. And it turned out that Gizmodo paid, and most reports say $5,000, but I've seen other reports that have different numbers in them, but Gizmodo paid a substantial amount of money for this prototype iPhone, which allegedly an Apple employee accidentally left on a bar. Now, interesting note, what the Apple employee left at the bar was this phone inside the shell of a iPhone 3GS. So, you know, when you first looked at it, it wouldn't have looked unusual, but somebody apparently realized that this was a not an ordinary iPhone 3GS, and first offered Engadget a chance to purchase this, and Engadget declined, and then they offered Gizmodo. Gizmodo, by the way, part of the Valleywag network, or Gawker network, that offered a substantial reward for leaks of the iPad a few months ago, and I believe we covered that on the podcast too. So, first thoughts, anyone want to chime in? You know, what, if any, liability has Gizmodo opened themselves up to?
There's just a lot of questions that I have more than actual answers. First, probably the most interesting thing to note is that a lot of the tech media bloggers and news reporters are currently saying that Gizmodo doesn't seem to have a whole lot of liability in this matter, and any liability that there is to be had by what happened probably falls on the guy that found it at the bar and then went on to sell it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So Gizmodo is going to have some benefit of the doubt here because they are press, and the press generally has a lot more leeway in these things. You know, for instance, there is a very famous case about papers that leaked with regard to the Vietnam War called the Pentagon Papers case. And yes, whoever leaked those papers was, you know, in a heap of trouble. But, you know, in the end, it was all right for the newspaper to publish them because they're press and it was important news. So, you know, it's a lot easier to get an underlying – to get somebody in trouble for underlying conduct than it is for publication of whatever came out of that conduct. And that's just because – you know, courts are very protective of First Amendment rights, and particularly the right of the press to publish these things. That being said, I've seen other analyses that say that Gizmodo's Apple would have Gizmodo pretty much dead to rights for any type of receipt of stolen property. I mean, that's generally a criminal thing, but you know, Gizmodo definitely knew that this phone was, you know, not properly acquired, even if it was lost, and they knew it belonged to somebody else. They should not have purchased it. You know, I think if Apple wants to go after them civilly, it's going to be a much more difficult thing. And I doubt that anyone would try to prosecute this criminally.
Ben?
Yeah,
you know what kind of disturbs me about this is the fact that this guy – so you have a engineer from Apple, right, who had the phone at a bar. And the story, I know, it's been recounted a bunch of different ways, but the one that I've heard the most is that he was field testing the device. And the guy has a couple – drinks too many and ends up leaving the bar without the phone, and some other guy finds the phone there. And it's so striking to me that how would the other guy know exactly what he had when he found the phone? And one story that I read said that he took the phone, he scanned through the phone, all the apps on the phone, and he found a Facebook app and was able to determine the guy's name who had left it at the bar there. So, and I don't know when that actually occurred, if it occurred after this guy who was on the phone left the bar and took it back home, or whether the guy checked this thing at the bar, and that might be relevant. But at some point, the guy takes the phone home, and I'm not really sure if he tried to reach out to contact the engineer to let him know that he left his phone there, but he dismantled the casing on the device and was able to determine by looking at it that he had some sort of unusual phone that wasn't a normal 3G phone or 3G iPhone, and then goes on to try to sell the device to other people without trying to return it to Apple. Or maybe I heard some accounts that said he tried to return it to Apple first before doing that. All those things kind of might be relevant here.
They certainly are. One thing that I've also heard is that the phone was rumored to have had a substantially higher resolution screen. So somebody who's really up on Apple products, you know, may have known from the second that they turned it on that it was not a standard Apple iPhone. I agree, though. You know, the devil is going to be in the details with regard to what steps the original finder took to return the phone to the owner or to Apple. What steps Engadget took once they were first informed of it and given the opportunity to buy, and what steps Gizmodo took once they found it. My impression is, and again, this is just stories that I've heard, you know, they acquired this sometime in the middle of March, mid to late March, and were holding on to it, you know, trying to get it to work, looking at it, eventually taking it apart and taking pictures of the internals, until they had enough that, you know, at some point they knew the shoe was going to drop, Apple was going to demand the phone back once they figured out who had it, and then they could, you know, leak the stuff over the course of a weekend trying to draw as much traffic as possible. You know, I heard one story that said that, you know, there were millions of views of probably each of these articles. And when you think of how many ads Gizmodo serves up on every page and the impressions, you know, even at a fairly low cost per thousand impressions for these ads, they more than made up for their $5,000 investment in the device.
So another thing here that's interesting is Gizmodo buys the phone, right? And they know that the phone does not belong to them, but they've paid an amount of money for it. And then they go ahead and take it apart. Does that bother anybody else?
Why would it be bothersome for them to take it apart if they already have it?
Because it's not their legal property. And I assume at least, that they purchased the device knowing that it had at least been found at a bar, and it was not the person who found it was not able to.
I mean, how is it not their legal property if they bought it without knowing that it was stolen? Just let's assume that that's true.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm going off of some of the stories which say that, you know, they paid an amount of money for, and they sort of knew the backstory that the phone was found at the bar, and that might not actually be true. Who knows what Gizmodo actually knew, but still, though, so just for legal property concepts here, a person who owns the phone itself owns legal title to it, and they retain legal title to it until they relinquish that right. So at the point at which that engineer had left it at the bar, he still owns title to the phone, even though he's not in possession of it at the time. And the guy that finds it does not get legal title just because he found the phone. He might be in possession of it, though, and at that point he probably becomes something that's known as a bailee. And there are certain duties that a bailee has to respect to that found property until he's able to get title to it. So say there's a statute in California that says after 2 or 3 years of finding a lost device, and if the person never comes around to claim it, then you get legal title. At that point, you would have the legal right to basically take it apart, dismantle it, smash it on the ground if you wanted to. But before then, you've got to worry about points of liability in terms of, like, you don't own the legal title to the phone, so you have to sort of take care of it at least until the owner comes back and claims it.
I think if one thing has been made clear to us throughout, you know, the stories is that Gizmodo was not in any way concerned with their legal liability here. And, you know, you have a decent point that they either knew or should have known that they, you know, didn't actually possess any type of legal title to the phone. You know, it was lost property that should have been returned to the owner. But you're drawing a pretty fine line between just not having, you know, they shouldn't have bought this phone in the first place, but then saying that, okay, fine, we'll give them that buying the phone, it was a good scoop. But once they bought it, they shouldn't have taken it apart. I mean, at that point, if you're taking the leap to buy the phone, you may as well take it apart, because at that point, that's just good journalism.
Yeah, I suppose, but then you've got to worry about trade secret aspects here, and I am willing to bet, and there are a lot of people who do not think that this would be an instance where Apple could go after Gizmodo for trade secret misappropriation, but there is a line of cases, and I don't know if they are binding within the state of California, that if you have some sort of notice upon acquiring some an item that might constitute a trade secret, if you have some knowledge that that might actually be a trade secret, then you got to worry about misappropriating that trade secret. And based on the fact that it was taken apart before it was given to Gizmodo and it was identified as a 4G iPhone, then once Gizmodo takes it and then continues to take it apart and photograph the internals, I don't know if they actually posted photographs of it, but inspect the internals and stuff like that, you've got someone who is prying into a potential trade secret, and that's just an additional point of liability.
If trade secret liability applies here, I'm going to interrupt you, Dominic, sorry. I think it would attach even before they took it apart and photographed and published the internals. Remember, Apple sued the founder and the guy who ran ThinkSecret a while back for just posting details about a project called Asteroid that was supposed to be some sort of FireWire box that attached to your computer and allowed for audio inputs. You know, I think that's enough to violate a trade secret law. And here, you know, usually for trade secrets, there has to be a misappropriation of a trade secret. And you have to, you know, get that information, the trade secret, by some sort of inappropriate means. So, you know, for the guy who just found it there, he's in the clear. At least I would say that, you know, he's fairly, if he just found it there. David, I keep on interrupting you.
Yeah, no, but is he really in the clear? He might have been in the clear up until the point where he took apart the casing and then determined that this was some type of new prototype iPhone, assuming that he had the technical acumen to do that. But at that point, when he realizes he's got some sort of secret Apple device that looks and feels to be a prototype, I think there was some accounts in the stories that he was going through the operating system, which did not look like the standard operating system, which is currently available on the 3G iPhones. And he noted that the functionality was pretty poor, that apps kept crashing and stuff. It sounds like that guy had pretty good notice at that point. He had a trade secret. And knowing that he had it, and he didn't even have to know the whole details of the law of trade secret, he then goes and sells it. And in the process of trying to sell this device to those, to both Engadget and Gizmodo, he's probably identifying to them that this is a prototype phone. So they're put on notice at that point. And the impropriety of this whole misappropriation really takes place in the method of obtaining the phone, being that Gizmodo then knows that it's a prototype and they're willing to pay money for it, and then go in and, on top of that, after they acquire it, go in and inspect the internals on it. All of that stuff is definitely information which is proprietary information that I'm sure Apple has a big vested interest in keeping secret. And not only that, it's also about publishing that information, then you've got an issue of damages in addition to just the misappropriation of the trade secret. And so discussing what the phone is on the inside and how it functions are all just different ways that Apple might be able to measure damages, stuff that's impacting basically their bottom line in some way, however you might perceive that, or maybe you say that there's no impact on their bottom line, this only generates interest in the device. But that's what I'm thinking, at least.
Yeah, I think it's a little murkier than you're giving it credit for as to when, in fact, trade secret misappropriation applies for the person who just found the phone. I think it's less murky for Gizmodo, who, you know, clearly knew or should have known that this phone was not acquired by totally appropriate means. You know, there have been some good analyses of California lost property law, and that, you know, Gizmodo is probably on the hook for receipt of stolen property, because property in California is considered stolen if the person who finds it doesn't return it, essentially. What I think is the more interesting trade secret question is that when you're looking for trade secrets, one of the factors that you have to consider is essentially whether or not it's a secret. And in those cases, you balance, you know, what kind of security measures were in place to protect the trade secret against, you know, what reasonable use had to be. So, you know, if you've got, you know, the Coca-Cola secret formula, which is, you know, in a lockbox at all time, no one person knows the entire formula, it's a pretty strong protection on it. If there's something like a phone that's a prototype, and apparently this guy was an engineer who worked on what's called the baseband, which it has to do with how the phone communicates with cell towers, you have to get that out and test it. And they seem to have fairly good procedures in place to try to ensure that these things didn't leak. You have to ask yourself, where is that line between enough protection to constitute a trade secret, and you know, just having it out there in public and in public use, where you've got a decent argument that there's, you know, it's not really secretive if, you know, this person has it in his pocket and is using it publicly.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, as I recall the standard, and I haven't brushed up on my trade secret law in a while. It's mostly about a reasonable means of secrecy, or taking reasonable measures to ensure secrecy of a trade secret. And if you, I guess an argument can just be made that they put this in a protective casing so that it would not appear to be, or it would appear to be a 3G iPhone and not the next generation iPhone. And based on that, I would think that, you know, the average person might not be able to ascertain just by looking at the device from a few feet away or even up close that it was in fact a 4G iPhone until it was taken apart. And that might be enough to maintain that level of secrecy that's required by common law.
Good points all around. So I think we're going to wrap this story up. We'll obviously keep tabs on it. My guess is Apple probably won't be filing any sort of legal action against Gizmodo. They'll just give them the Apple cold shoulder from now on when it comes to events, at least for a little while. So I guess the... yes, David?
Sorry, I was just going to see if Dominic had any thoughts, because I know he tried to interject a couple of times.
I guess... briefly, I don't think the trade secret liability was going to attach to the guy who found the phone, at least. It doesn't attach instantly. He doesn't know what he has. And even if he learns what he has, if he's not going to try to make money off of it, he's not in trouble. And it's not evident that he was trying to make money off of it directly. He wasn't selling it to a competitor. He was selling it to Gizmodo. And if he really didn't steal the phone and just found it in a bar, which is the story that I think... at least is the current story that seems to be the one, then, I mean, I'm not familiar with the California law about stolen property or lost property being stolen, but it doesn't seem like he'd be in that much trouble. I'd say that it's really Gizmodo who would be bearing the brunt of the legal fury.
The thing that I thought was interesting was the theory that this was not actually a lost iPhone, but Apple had... accidentally, in air quotes, lost it in order to get advanced publicity for their new product. But that would be a break from Apple's previous strategy, and publicity does not seem to be one thing that they need very much of. So, but could be true.
Right. I mean, those all sound like good points all around. I mean, one kind of has to wonder why there isn't any direct legal threats against Gizmodo at this point. The last tidbit that I heard from the Gizmodo folks is that they did receive a letter which was a official demand requesting the device be returned, but as far as I know, there was no letters which indicated that they were going to pursue Gizmodo in a court or anything like that for any of these things. And my only last parting thoughts are, I guess possibly for Apple, maybe there is no legal liability here, or maybe their internal counsel doesn't think so, or maybe this is more of a case of, like, they don't want to draw more attention to this than they already have, and they'd just rather move on. So I think our next story here is another interesting one. There's a movie called Downfall, and it sort of depicts the downfall of the Third Reich and Hitler in his final days. There are literally hundreds of clips, it's just this one clip of Hitler going on a rant in a room full of his subordinates, and it's all in German, and I haven't actually seen the movie myself, but I suspect that the movie has subtitles, especially for this portion of it, so it's all in German, and Hitler is going absolutely nuts about stuff, and what people have done is they've taken this clip of the movie and inserted their own subtitles, and often they're absolutely hilarious. If you haven't seen any of these, go check it out. These things have been around for a really long time. I think I remember seeing them as far back as at least a year ago, probably more than that even. And I guess what happened on April 20th, which as far as I remember is actually Hitler's birthday, the company who produced the movie has started issuing DMCA takedown notices to websites like Vimeo and YouTube, and requesting that this content be taken down because it constitutes a violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and the videos, after they've been uploaded, constitute copyright infringement. And apparently a guy out of the EFF, and I don't have his name in front of me, but he made one of these clips and inserted his own subtitles, which included a bunch of commentary about how the production company was issuing takedown notices. And in fact, that video, and it was meant to be like a critical commentary on the producers of the movie, And in fact, that particular instance of, or that particular video that was uploaded, was taken down subsequently. And I think the guy from the EFF eventually issued a counter notice saying that this is fair use, and the video is back up. And I think a lot of them are back up. But this is kind of funny, and it's a good platform, I guess, to discuss video uploads on some of these websites and fair use. So, did you guys have any thoughts on this initially, or did you guys want to insert your own subtitles right now to some of these Hitler rants?
Well, I do want to chime in and say that Downfall is a fantastic film, and it's very good for anyone who has any interest in the Second World War. That being said, I'm really kind of surprised that it took them this long, them in this case being the movie studio, to issue this takedown notice. It seems like, you know, this has been a meme in the United States for quite a long time, and either they didn't care about it until now, or something must have flipped somewhere where either, you know, I just don't know what would have triggered them to do this now when the Downfall meme's been around for probably a year and a half. I feel like it's been floating around there for a little while. Any idea what would, you know, trigger them to do this now?
Sorry, just for the record, the movie came out in, I believe, 2004, and the earliest version of the meme came out in 2006, and I think a lot of people came to familiarity with it in 2007 or 8 with a lot of political ones, you know, with John McCain or Hillary Clinton as the rantier in the movie. But anyway, go ahead.
No, I mean, I have absolutely no idea what prompted them at this point to start taking these things down. My only guess is that the producers don't like these clips with the new subtitles, and that they somehow perceive these clips to damage the value of the movie, which I really don't agree with on a personal level. But maybe for that reason, they want these videos or these clips off.
I mean, I'll say that they do a disservice to the film, which, as I mentioned, is a very good film. But at the same time, they do a funny disservice to the film. As for fair use, I wonder how many of these would actually constitute fair use. Of the ones that I've seen, I think the one that's most likely to constitute fair use is, in fact, the one, I think it was Brad Templeton, thank you for pulling up that name, Dominic, by the way, who's a member of the EFF board, who posted the Downfall rant about taking down of the Downfall rants. That would come the closest to being a fair use, because it's not only a commentary, it's a commentary on the own piece. It's kind of making a parody of Downfall and the Downfall rants using Downfall. And when you're using, you know, original work for a parody of that work, I think you're more likely to find, you know, that it was transformative and that it's fair use than when you're using, you know, the Downfall clip to do a rant about going to Toronto and using their public transportation system, which it was either Toronto or Montreal, which was in fact one of the Downfall parodies. You know, when you're using it to parody something else, I think at least the case law says that it's less likely to be fair use than when you're using it to parody itself.
Yeah, right. So fair use, I mean, we have gone over this so many times, but it doesn't make sense to go over all the factors that need to be considered for it, but the statute does pretty make clear that you can make reproductions of a copyrighted work, and it will not constitute copyright infringement for uses like criticism, commentary, news, reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research. But all of those things generally go to, you know, making criticism or commentary on the copyrighted work itself and not on other things. And so they're sort of using this clip then as a vehicle to comment on other things. I mean, there's a number of clips which talk about technology issues. I've seen them like PlayStation 3 versus Xbox 360 and stuff. Those are really funny. You should check them out, by the way. And all sorts of other stuff, like you mentioned, Montreal and whatever, and so it does seem less likely, though, that some of these would be fair use if you're using that clip to comment on other stuff. But it might also still be like a de minimis instance of infringement, meaning like the clip that they're using is probably, I think it's about three minutes or 4 minutes long. It's not very much when you compare that to the entire movie itself. You're talking about a very small portion that was used. And honestly, like, the first time I saw one of these, which was a really long time ago, I thought, this must be a really good movie, because this looks like it's a really good bit of acting, and the guy that portrays Hitler in the movie, it looks pretty authentic, and it actually, you know, prompted me to note it, at least, or maybe queue it up on my Netflix list to check it out, even though
I haven't yet. Have you seen the movie, Ben? Or anyone?
Yes, as I mentioned a couple of times already, I have seen the movie.
Oh, so what prompted you to actually see it? Was it this clip, or was it something else beforehand?
It was both. It was actually the clip, but embarrassingly, I hadn't heard of the clip before I first heard of the clip on a podcast that a friend of mine does that I'm totally going to plug now. Sorry, guys. It's called Overthinking It, and you can just Google Overthinking It, and they'll pop up. They were talking about the Downfall clip, but in the structure of talking about the movie Downfall, and I looked it up after they talked about it, and then saw the clip and then saw the movie because I felt like it was the appropriate thing to do. I mean, I didn't think that the movie was particularly brilliant from the clip. I thought it was particularly brilliant because the people at Overthinking It told me that it was particularly brilliant.
You know, another funny point that I remember reading from some of these stories talking about this was that the director of the movie actually loves these clips, but of course he doesn't have the rights to the copyright. So even though he loves them and, you know, says keep doing them, he doesn't have the ability to authorize other people to continue to make reproductions of the clip itself. All those rights go to the producers.
I can say that I added the movie to my Netflix queue thanks to the clips. So,
but you haven't seen it yet.
Not yet.
So, do we have any, aside from all your lovely movie reviews, do any of you guys have any thoughts on? I think we've sort of established that it's a little bit murky here for some of these clips, at least, whether or not they constitute fair use. But do we have a consensus then that some of these takedowns are actually okay, or what do you guys think?
I'd lean toward some of them being legitimate takedowns, and you know, a minority of them not being legitimate takedowns. That being said, I don't think it was doing anyone harm keeping them up, and I would have rather seen the company not send these takedown notices. That being said, Downfall, which was, as Dave Liu mentioned, it's a rather old film, has suddenly gotten a big round of publicity again, and maybe that was the point of it. Maybe they just wanted to drive sales of a new special edition DVD that's coming out, or something along those lines.
Dominic, what do you think about some of the fair use here, or whether this is actually fair use?
It's a pretty long clip that they use for the parody. Like, it's several minutes long, and it's uninterrupted, and from what I understand, it's basically ripped right out of the film as it is in the film. The only thing that all the parodies change are the subtitles, but since it's such a long portion of the film, and it's taken in its entirety except for the subtitles, I mean, the audio is there. If you understand German, you understand what they're really saying. I think they might get into trouble with just the amount of the film that they're taking. Like, it's not a short, brief parody. It's a good 3 or 4 minute parody. Some of them are completely not at all related to the film at all. There's no reason why they would be using that film to parody it, apart from the humor value of having Hitler rant about something. And it just doesn't seem like that would be enough for some of these things.
I agree. Any last thoughts from the panel? I'm all set.
I think we've touched on this before, but I don't know if this is something that can actually be stopped. Like, at one point we discussed the legal copyright on the photographs that are used in lolcat images, and you know, regardless of whether the original photographer actually would like to contain it, it's sort of the Barbra Streisand effect in that I don't think that there's any real way to keep these from being made. Maybe you can keep them off of YouTube and a couple of the other popular video hosting sites, but overall, I think the cat is out of the bag.
All right. Well, David Liu, do you? I think you have our final story for this week.
Yeah, so this is the case of the U.S. versus David C. Kernel, which I believe is how you pronounce that, and it's in the U.S. District Court of Eastern District of Tennessee at Knoxville. And it concerns, some alleged hacking of Sarah Palin's private email address. So there's a number, at least two different emails that Sarah Palin used for different purposes. The first is gov.sarah@yahoo.com, which is actually the, quote, public email address. And then there was gov.palin@yahoo.com. which hadn't really been acknowledged as a real email address for her, but has later been confirmed as such. And the defendant allegedly used publicly known information about Sarah Palin to get access to her account. So sent a password request by sending in her date of birth, zip code where she lives, and where she met her husband. And so that was apparently enough information to get Yahoo to reset the account. And so he got access to the gov.palin account and was therefore able to expose a lot of the emails and take screenshots of her Yahoo account. And so this includes things like different emails with some government officials and other colleagues of hers, family photos, and at least I believe the phone number of her daughter, Bristol. And this resulted in a number of things, including harassing emails sent to the various people whose emails were included in there, and a bunch of voicemails to Bristol Palin. He posted this information on the notorious message board 4chan, the B section, and without going too far into what actually happened there, the password got out to a lot of different people, and various people tried to gain access, and eventually the account was locked because of too many people trying to log in, and then it eventually came to the attention of the McCain-Palin campaign. So the defendant had actually posted some information on Facebook about finding nothing incriminating on in there. I'm not sure quite what he was hoping to find, but at the very least he was hoping to find something to damage her political career. One of the wrinkles in this case is that Sarah Palin is a noted Republican, and the defendant is the son of a, I believe, Memphis state senator, which doesn't really have any legal bearing, but could make things more complicated. Once he found out that the FBI was investigating him, he locked his Facebook account and deleted history files and a bunch of other folders and information pertaining to this activity off of his computer. And so he is being charged with identity theft, wire fraud, entering email without permission, and interfering with an FBI investigation because of deleting the files, and I believe he fled them when they investigated his apartment. So any initial thoughts on this story?
I think the penalty that they want to give this guy, 50 years in jail, is way, way disproportionate for what he did. Like, I'm sorry, but...
Yeah, maybe, that's a little absurd.
Maybe this is just a stupid incident, incident of just like someone trying to use obscurity in order to secure their webmail account. I mean, if you think about how those, you know, I've lost my password, you know, click here type requests work on a lot of webmail programs... You know, the next couple steps are, well, let's ask you some personal questions about yourself, and we can verify your identity before we reset your password. For public figures, a lot of that information is available all over the place, especially for potential vice president candidates like Sarah Palin was. And, you know, it was probably a mistake that she didn't, you know, use some sort of alternative information and to fill in those fields when she made the account, or at least try to switch it up after she had the account. That said, I mean, obviously that doesn't change the legal liability at all in this case, but, you know, I guess it's a little unfortunate that the folks on her campaign or whatever advisor she might have didn't say, you know, you should tighten all your mediums of communication down, especially those that are based on the Internet, because, as everybody knows, Sarah Palin was a huge public figure during the campaign, and there was a lot of controversy was constantly surrounding her.
So one of the interesting legal wrinkles, I think, here is what actually constitutes identity in this case. So the prosecution is arguing that by fraudulently accessing her email, the defendant stole her identity. But the defense attorney in this case said, quote, transfer use of possession of an email address and a birthday does not constitute identity theft. And so I believe he was petitioning to have that part of it dropped. But U.S. Magistrate Judge Clifford Shelley then ruled that it did in fact make up the identity, saying, quote, the court finds that Governor Palin's Yahoo ID is a unique electronic address. The court also finds that this unique address identifies a specific individual, Governor Palin. Although the defendant is correct that theoretically anyone could choose to have a Yahoo ID that incorporates portions of Governor Palin's. Once Governor Palin chose the Yahoo ID, that became her unique address and no one else could choose it. Do you guys agree with that?
No.
Ooh, hey, disagreement. I agree with that analysis, that it could be. So one thing, the judge wasn't saying that this was conclusively identity theft. He was saying that a jury could find that it was identity theft. You know, he wasn't in the position to make a final determination about that in this case. He was just saying that there's enough here that, you know, that the fact that that email was associated with Sarah Palin is enough that if somebody hijacks it, they could have committed identity theft. You know, there's probably more that the government's going to have to prove. But Dominic, why don't you think that's identity theft?
Well, I mean, I guess my instinctive gut reaction to the disagreement was simply the last bit there, that just because she registered the address, it's hers forever and ever, and no one else can have it. That just isn't right.
It's yeah, that's a fair point. If I had registered dominic.rabier@gmail.com and then you took that from me, would that be identity theft? I don't think so.
No. So.
Well, also, terms of service agreements that when you go in and make an account on a lot of these web-based email programs, they often have provisions in them which basically say we reserve the right to take away this address to you at any given time. So, just by that little contract tweak right there, you know, that's not like a piece of property that you own that ultimately constitutes your identity. The other thing that sort of bothers me about this is that it didn't sound like the kid who originally went in and was able to change the password actually sent out any emails on Sarah Palin's behalf or, you know, pretending to be Sarah Palin, but there were other people that might have done that. So I would be more willing to believe that the other people who went in and sent out those harassing emails, that might fall along the lines of identity theft. But just because he gained access to the account and then released the password information online, that probably doesn't seem to be enough, at least in my book, to constitute identity theft.
I mean, I'm no expert on identity theft, but it seems like there would have to be some impersonation, and therefore sending out emails would, at least in my non-legal perspective, constitute identity theft in some manner. But without actually doing any of that, you know, it's sort of just the open it up and look around idea. That might be illegal, but I wouldn't call it identity theft.
I mean, I guess the troubling part about this story is that, to me, it almost doesn't feel like he hacked into her account. Like, the reason I say that is because he didn't do anything out of the ordinary to do it. I mean, he took public information and recovered her password, and Yahoo gave it to him just as they would for her. It's, I mean, the questions that she set, I mean, were notoriously unsecure, and I guess my point is that it just doesn't feel like what he did rises to identity theft or even hacking. He just went into, I mean, he didn't take anything out of, I mean.
Not to cut you off, I mean, within the strict definition of what we here on this panel might consider hacking or cracking for that matter, I mean, no, this was not a traditional crack where he used any like technical acumen in order to gain access to this account. He answered a bunch of simple questions based on publicly available information. That's all true. But the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act doesn't really, you know, define hacking so much. It just defines what unauthorized access is. And I'm willing to bet, though, that any court out there is going to consider some means of usurping somebody else's password to their webmail account is probably plenty of grounds in order to satisfy gaining unauthorized access into an account. And just by that legal definition, I guess it is kind of hacking, if you want to call it that.
But
or just
that legal definition is so broad that if I leave my laptop unattended for 5 minutes and you walk over and look at my Gmail account, then you've committed unauthorized access to a computer?
Exactly, yeah, and I would agree with that too, because you haven't given any authorization in order to go through your email. And if you know, maybe they're, what you're thinking is that, you know, I didn't do any harm, and there is a requirement for damages under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but it's a very low threshold to meet. That said, though, I mean, just I could go, if I went onto a company's computer without access and browsed through, say, the, I don't know, the history log in Internet Explorer, or went through some of the company's proprietary files, even though I didn't do anything, I'm not supposed to be there. And I think without a statute like that that's so broadly written, it's difficult to have anti-hacking or cracking statutes to begin with.
So I think at time of recording this, we haven't heard anything from the defense yet, at least in the actual trial. From what I understand, their defense is that it was basically a prank. And I'm not really sure whether or not that's a good defense. Do you guys think that is some way to get around this these charges? Or perhaps is there another defense to be made on some sort of whistleblower grounds, in the fact that, you know, I mean, sort of like the what we were talking about before with, I don't know, illegal things done by the press in order to gain information, or a lot of the stuff that WikiLeaks deals with. You know, there is some speculation that Sarah Palin was using this email address illegally, that she was using both of these Yahoo accounts for government-related business, and due to the Freedom of Information Act, she should have been using her official governor email, and therefore exposing what was going on in these emails was, in fact, evidence of government use, and therefore, I don't know, good for society as a whole to make this information aware. So I pose that question. Is there a defense to be made that it was just a prank, or that he was a whistleblower?
As I mentioned before, you know, liability in these cases attaches to the person who did the illegal act in the first place, but generally the press can avoid any type of liability. So here, you know, yes, he you know, blew whistles, and, you know, yes, there was some public service that was served by exposing the fact that, you know, the governor was using an unofficial email for official purposes. But I don't think that really gets him out of any criminal liability here. Dave, were you thinking along the same lines?
Yeah, kind of. First of all, I don't think he's going to have a hell of a time getting around the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and that provision, which, you know, basically says if you exceed authorized access on a computer system that you're criminally liable at that point. I do think, though, that what the defense is trying to do here is sort of mitigate his ultimate sentence in the case. And maybe if they frame it to be, well, this was a prank, this wasn't really meant to cause all this much harm, maybe then the judge is going to be a little bit more lenient in his ultimate sentencing. And as for the Freedom of Information Act arguments and whether or not she was using this account within the bounds of the law, that doesn't really go to any of the legal issues in this case. That's an entirely separate legal issue that would have to be disputed somewhere else. And even still, I don't think that an argument that this information should have been out there to begin with because she was using this for official purposes even holds true, because those disclosures under the Freedom of Information Act are made by the government. You can't really get around the fact that it's the government that has to release that information. If you're going to go into a computer system without authorized access and then disclose all of them, that, you know, that's not a disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. It also has the Freedom of Information Act is a very detailed statute that explains what exactly has to be released to the public and on what timeline. So, you know, to take that into your own hands as a citizen of this country, it doesn't really hold true that, you know, just because that there's some wayward argument that this information should be out there, that is going to suddenly nullify all these other statutes which impute criminal liability on someone who's exceeded authorized access on a system.
Right, and to address Dave's question very briefly about pranks, a prank is no defense to a criminal act. You know, you can't say, well, I only stole the the assistant principal's car and I put it on the roof because it was a prank. You're still, you know, you still stole his car. It's going to serve one of two purposes. One, to help convince the judge to not sentence the kid to 50 years in prison, or two, to get the jury to do something which is called nullification, where the jury goes, you know what, yes, you know, yes, he committed a crime, and yes, it's technically a crime, but we're not going to find him guilty because he did it for a good reason, or, you know, it's not the kind of stuff that we think should actually be criminalized. Nullification is a really tough argument to make, because juries tend to apply the law correctly and as they're instructed and not, you know, make it up as they go along.
All right, any final thoughts on the story?
Nope. I'm all set. Dominic?
All set.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. You may have noticed that we're doing a new format. If you like it, if you don't like it, send us comments to podcast@technicallylegal.org or visit our website and comment on the podcast post. And that's www.technicallylegal.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @TechLegal. So, signing off, I'm Ben Snitko.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening. So, starting with the Gizmodo trial, I'm sorry, we're going to roll that back. Can we roll the tape back, guys? Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Great, right there. Okay.